From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly reading David Edding's Book 5 of The Malorian, The Seeress of Kell. We begin with the prologue. Excerpts from the Book of Ages, Book 1 of the Malorian Gospels. Now these are the ages of man. In the first age was man created, and he awoke in puzzlement and wonder as he beheld the world about him. And those that had made him considered him and selected from his number those that pleased them. And the rest were cast out and driven away. And some went in search of the spirit known as Ul, and they left us, and passed into the west, and we saw them no more. And some denied the gods, and they went into the far north to wrestle with the demons. And some turned to worldly matters, and they went away into the east, and built mighty cities there. But we despaired, and we sat us down upon the earth in the shadow of the mountains of Korim. And in bitterness we bewailed our fate, that we had been made and then cast out. And it came to pass that in the midst of our grief a woman of our people was seized by a rapture, and it was as if she had been shaken by a mighty hand. And she arose from the earth upon which she sat, and she bound her eyes with a cloth, signifying that she had seen that which no mortal had seen before. For lo, she was the first seeress in all of the world. And with the touch of her vision still upon her, she spake unto us, saying,
Behold, a feast hath been set before those who made us, and this feast shall ye call the Feast of Life. And those who made us have chosen that which pleased them, and that which pleased them not was not chosen. Now we are the Feast of Life, and ye sorrow that no guest at the feast hath chosen ye. Despair not, however, for one guest hath not yet arrived at the feast. The other guests have taken their fill, but this great Feast of Life awaiteth still the beloved guest who cometh late. And I say unto all the people, that it is he who will choose us. Abide therefore against his coming, for it is certain. Put aside thy grief, and turn thy face to the sky and to the earth, that thou mayest read the signs written there. For this I say unto all the people, it is upon ye that his coming rests. For behold, he may not choose ye, unless ye choose him. And this is the fate for which we were made. Rise up, therefore, and sit no more upon the earth in vain and foolish lamentation. Take up the task which lies before ye, and prepare the way for him who will surely come.
Much we marveled at these words, and we considered them most carefully. We questioned the seeress, but her answers were dark and obscure. And so it was that we turned our faces to the sky and bent our ears to the whispers which came from the earth, that we might see and hear and learn. And as we learned to read the book of the skies and to hear the whispers within the rocks, we found myriad warnings that two spirits would come to us, and that the one was good and the other evil. Long we labored, but still were sorely troubled, for we could not determine which spirit was the true one, and which the false. For truly evil is disguised as good in the book of the heavens, and in the speech of the earth, and no man is wise enough to choose between them. Pondering this, we went out from beneath the shadow of the mountains of Korim, and into the lands beyond, where we abode. And we put aside the concerns of man, and bent all our efforts to the task that lay before us. Our witches and our seers sought the aid of the spirit world. Our necromancers took counsel with the dead, and our diviners sought advice from the earth. But lo, none of these knew more than we. Then gathered we at last upon a fertile plain to bring together all that we had learned. And these are the truths that we have learned from the stars, from the rocks, from the hearts of men, and from the minds of the spirits. Know ye that all down the endless avenues of time hath division marred all that is, for there is division at the very heart of creation. And some have said that this is natural and will persist until the end of days. But it is not so. Were the division destined to be eternal, then the purpose of creation would be to contain it. But the stars and the spirits and the voices within the rocks speak of the day when the division will end, and all will be made one again. For creation itself knows that the day will come. Know ye further that two spirits contend with each other at the very center of time, and these spirits are the two sides of that which hath divided creation. And in a certain time shall those spirits meet upon this world, and then will come the time of the choice. And if the choice be not made, then shall this world vanish, and the beloved guest of whom the seeress spoke will never come. For it is this which she meant, which she said to us,
Behold, he may not choose ye, unless ye choose him.
And the choice that we must make is the choice between good and evil, and the division between good and evil, and the reality that will exist after we have made the choice, will be a reality of good or a reality of evil, and it will prevail so until the end of days. Behold also this truth. The rocks of this world and of all other worlds murmur continually of the two stones that lie at the center of the division. Once these stones were one, and they stood at the very center of all creation. But like all else, they were divided, and in the instant of division, they were rent apart with a force that destroyed whole suns. And where these stones came into the presence of each other again, there surely will be the last confrontation between the two spirits. Now the day will come when all will be made one again, except that the division between the two stones is so great that they can never be rejoined. And in the day when the division ends, shall one of the stones cease forever to exist. And in that day also shall one of the spirits forever vanish. These then were the truths that we had gathered. And it was our discovery of these truths that marked the end of the first age. Now the second age of man began in thunder and earthquake. For lo, the earth herself split apart, and the sea rushed in to divide the lands of men, even as creation itself is divided. And the mountains of Corim shuddered and groaned, and heaved as the sea swallowed them. And we knew that this would come to pass, for our seers had warned us that it would be so. We went our way, therefore, and found safety before the world was cracked, and the sea first rushed away, and then rushed back, and never departed more. And in the days that followed the rushing in of the sea, the children of the dragon god fled from the waters, and they abode to the north of us beyond the mountains. Now our seers told us that the children of the dragon god would one day come among us as conquerors, and we took counsel with each other and considered how we might least offend the children of the dragon god when they should come, so that they would not interrupt our studies. In the end, we concluded that our warlike neighbors would be least apprehensive about simple tillers of the soil living in rude communities on the land, and so we ordered our lives. We pulled down our cities and carried away the stones, and we betook ourselves back to the land so that we might not alarm our neighbors nor arouse their envy. And the years passed and became centuries, and the centuries passed and became aeons. And as we had known they would, the children of Angorak came down amongst us and established their overlordship. And they called the lands in which we dwelt Talasia, and we did what they wished us to do and continued our studies. Now at about this time, it came to pass in the far north that a disciple of the god Aldur came with certain others to reclaim a thing that the dragon god had stolen from Aldur. And that act was so important that when it was done, the second age ended and the third age began. Now it was in the third age that the priests of Angorak, which men called Grolems, came to speak to us of the dragon god and of his hunger for our love. And we considered what they said, even as we considered all things men told us. And we consulted the Book of the Heavens and confirmed that Torak was the incarnate god aspect of one of the spirits which contend at the center of time. But where was the other? How might men choose when but one of the spirits came to them? Then it was that we perceived our dreadful responsibility. The spirits would come to us, each in its own time, and each would proclaim that it was good and the other was evil. It was man, however, who would choose. And we took counsel among ourselves, and we concluded that we might accept the forms of the worship that the Grolems so urgently pressed upon us. This would give us the opportunity to examine the nature of the dragon god, and make us better prepared to choose when the other god appeared. In time, the events of the world intruded upon us. The Angoraks allied themselves by marriage with the great city builders of the East, who called themselves Melsine, and between them they built an empire that bestrode the continent. Now the Angoraks were doers of deeds, but the Melsines were performers of tasks. A deed once done is done forever, but a task returns every day. And the Melsines came among us to seek out those who might aid them in their endless tasks. Now as it chanced to happen, one of our kinsmen, who aided the Melsines, had occasion to journey to the north in performance of one of those tasks. And he came to a place called Ashaba, and sought shelter there from a storm that had overtaken him. And the master of the house at Ashaba was neither Grolem nor Angorak, nor any other man. Our kinsmen had become unaware upon the house of Torak. Now Torak was curious about our people, and he sent for the traveler, and our kinsman went in to behold the dragon god. And in the instant that he looked upon the face of Torak, the third age ended, and the fourth age began. For lo, the dragon god of Angorak was not one of the gods for whom we waited. The signs that were upon him did not lead beyond him, and our kinsmen saw in an instant that Torak was doomed, and that which he was would die with him. And then we perceived our error, and we marveled at what we had not seen, that even a god might be but the tool of destiny. For behold, Torak was of one of the two fates, but he was not the entire fate. Now it happened that on the far side of the world a king was slain, and all of his family with him, save one. And this king had been the keeper of one of the two stones of power. And when word of this was brought to Torak, he exulted, for he believed that an ancient foe was no more. Then it was that he began his preparations to do war upon the kingdoms of the West. But the signs in the heavens, and the whispers in the rocks, told us that it was not as Torak believed. The stone was still guarded, and the line of the guardian remained unbroken. Torak's war would bring him to grief. The preparations of the dragon god were long, and the tasks he laid upon his people were the tasks of generations. And even as we, Torak watched the heavens to read there the signs that would tell him when to move against the West. But Torak watched only for the signs he wished to see, and he did not read the entire message written in the sky. Reading thus but a small part of the signs, he set his forces in motion on the worst possible day. And, as we had known it must, disaster befell the armies of Torak on a broad plain lying before the city of Vomimbre in the far west. And the dragon god was bound in sleep to await the coming of his enemy. And then it was that a whisper began to reach us with yet another name. The whisper of that name became clearer to us, and upon the day of his birth, the whisper of his name became a great shout. Belgarion, the God-slayer, had come at last. And now the pace of events quickened, and the rush toward the awful meeting became so swift that the pages of the Book of the Heavens became as a blur. And then upon the day that men celebrate as the day the world was made, the Stone of Power was delivered up to Belgarion. And in the instant that his hand closed upon it, the Book of the Heavens filled with a great light, and the sound of Belgarion's name rang from the farthest star. And then we felt Belgarion moving toward Meloria, bearing the Stone of Power, and we could feel Torak stirring as his sleep grew fitful. And finally, there came that dreadful night. As we watched helplessly, the vast pages of the Book of the Heavens moved so rapidly that we could not read them. And then the book stopped, and we read one terrible line. Torak is slain. And the book shuddered, and all of the light in all of creation went out. And in that awful instant of darkness and silence, the fourth age ended, and the fifth age began. And as the fifth age began, we found a mystery in the Book of the Heavens. Before, all had moved toward the meeting between Belgarion and Torak. But now the events moved toward a different meeting. There were signs among the stars which told us that the fates had selected yet other aspects for their final encounter, and we could feel the movements of those presences. But we knew not who or what they might be, for the pages of the great book were dark and obscure. Yet we felt a presence shrouded and veiled in darkness, and it moved through the affairs of men, and the moon spoke most clearly, advising us that this dark presence was a woman. One thing we saw in all the vast confusion that now clouded the Book of the Heavens. The ages of man grew shorter as each one passed, and the events that were the meetings between the two fates were growing closer and closer together. The time for leisurely contemplation had passed, and now we must hasten lest the last event come upon us all unaware. We decided that we must goad or deceive the participants in that final event so that they should both come to the appointed place at the destined time. And we sent the similitude of she who must make the choice to the veiled and hooded presence of Dark and to Belgarion the Godslayer. And she set them upon the path that would lead them at last to the place of our choosing. And then we all turned to our preparations, for much remained to be done, and we knew that this event would be the last. The division of creation had endured for too long, and in this meeting, between the two fates, the division would end, and all would be made one again. Part 1. Kel. Chapter 1. The air was thin and cool, and richly scented with the odor of trees that shed no leaves but stood dark, green, and resinous from one end of their lives to the other. The sunlight on the snowfields above them was dazzling, and the sound of tumbling waters seething down and down rocky stream beds to feed rivers leagues below on the plains of Darshiva and Gandahar was constantly in their ears. That tumble and roar of waters rushing to their destined meeting with the great river Magan was accompanied by the soft, melancholy sighing of an endless wind passing through the deep green forest of pine and fir and spruce, which clad hills that reached toward the sky in a kind of unthinking yearning. The caravan route Garion and his friends followed rose up and up, winding along stream beds and mounting the sides of ridges. From atop each ridge, they could see yet another, and looming over all was the spine of the continent where peaks beyond imagining soared upward to touch the very vault of heaven, peaks pure and pristine in their mantle of eternal snow. Geryon had spent time in mountains before, but never had he seen such enormous peaks. He knew that those colossal spires were leagues and leagues away, but the mountain air was so clear that it seemed he could almost reach out and touch them. There was an abiding peace here, a peace that washed away the turmoil and anxiety that had beset them all on the plains below, and somehow erased care and even thought. Each turn and each ridgetop brought new vistas, each filled with more splendor than the last, until they could only ride in silence and wonder. The works of man shrank into insignificance here. Man would never, could never, touch these eternal mountains. It was summer, and the days were long and filled with sunlight. Birds sang from the trees beside the winding track, and the smell of sun-warmed evergreens was touched lightly with the delicate odors of the acre upon acre of wildflowers carpeting the steep meadows. Occasionally, the wild, shrill cry of an eagle echoed from the rocks.
"Have you ever considered moving your capital?"
Geryon asked the Emperor of Meloria, who rode beside him. His tone was hushed. To speak in a louder voice would somehow profane what lay around them.
"No, not really, Geryon," Zakath replied. "My government would not function here. The bureaucracy is largely Mersenne. Mersennes appear to be prosaic people, but actually they are not. I am afraid my officials would spend about half their time looking at the scenery and the other half writing bad poetry. Nobody would get any work done. Besides, you have no idea what it is like up here in the winter."
"Snow?"
Zakath nodded.
"People up here don't bother to measure it in inches. They measure it in feet."
"Are there people up here? I haven't seen any."
"There are a few. Fur trappers, gold hunters, that sort of thing."
Zakath smiled faintly.
"I think it's just an excuse, really. Some people prefer solitude."
"This is a good place for it."
The Emperor of Meloria had changed since they had left Ateska's enclave on the banks of the Magan. He was leaner now, and the dead look was gone from his eyes. Like Geryon and all the rest, he rode warily, his eyes and ears constantly alert. It was not so much his outward aspect that marked the change in him. Zakath had always been a pensive, even melancholy man, given often to periods of black depression, but filled at the same time with a cold ambition. Geryon had often felt that the Malorian's ambition and his apparent hunger for power were not so much a driving need in him, as they had been a kind of continual testing of himself, and, at perhaps a deeper level, deriving from an urge toward self-destruction. It had seemed almost that Zakath had hurled himself, and all the resources of his empire, into impossible struggles, in the secret hope that eventually he would encounter someone strong enough to kill him, and thereby relieve him of the burden of a life that was barely tolerable to him. Such was no longer the case. His meeting with Saradas on the banks of the Magan had forever changed him. A world that had always been flat and stale now seemed to be all new to him. At times, Geryon even thought he detected a faint touch of hope in his friend's face, and hope had never been a part of Zakath's makeup. As they rounded a wide bend in the track, Geryon saw the she-wolf he had found in the dead forest back in Darshiva. She sat patiently on her haunches waiting for them. Increasingly, the behavior of the wolf puzzled him. Now that her injured paw was healed, she made sporadic sweeps through the surrounding forests in search of her pack, but always returned, seemingly unconcerned about her failure to locate them. It was as if she were perfectly content to remain with them as a member of their most unusual pack. So long as they were in forests and uninhabited mountains, this peculiarity of hers caused no particular problems. But they would not always be in the wilderness, and the appearance of an untamed and probably nervous wolf on the busy street of a populous city would be likely to attract attention, to say the very least. "How is it with you, little sister?" he asked her politely in the language of wolves.
"It is well,"
she replied. "Did you find any traces of your pack?"
"There are many other wolves about, but they are not of my kindred. One will remain with you for yet a while longer. Where is the young one?"
Geryon glanced back over his shoulder at the little two-wheeled carriage trundling along behind him.
"He sits beside my mate in the thing with round feet."
The wolf sighed.
"If he sits much longer, he will no longer be able to run or hunt," she said disapprovingly. "And if your mate continues to feed him so much, she will stretch his belly, and he will not survive a lean season when there is little food."
"One will speak with her about it."
"Will she listen?"
"Probably not, but one will speak with her all the same. She is fond of the young one, and takes pleasure in having him near her."
"Soon one will need to teach him how to hunt."
"Yes, one knows. One will explain that to one's mate."
"One is grateful."
She paused, looking about a bit warily.
"Proceed with some caution,"
she warned.
"There is a creature who dwells here. One has caught his scent several times, though one has not seen him. He is quite large, however."
"How large?"
"Larger than the beast upon which you sit."
She looked pointedly at Gretchen. Familiarity had made the big gray stallion less nervous in the presence of the she-wolf, though Geryon suspected that he would be much happier if she did not come quite so close.
"One will tell the pack leader of what you have said," Geryon promised.
For some reason, the she-wolf avoided Belgarath. Geryon surmised that her behavior might reflect some obscure facet of wolfly etiquette, of which he was not aware.
"One will continue one's search, then,"
she said, rising to her feet.
"It may happen that one will come upon this beast, and then we will know him."
She paused.
"His scent tells one that he is dangerous, however. He feeds on all things, even on things that we would shun."
Then she turned and loped off into the forest, moving swiftly and silently.
"That's really uncanny, you know,"
Sakath observed.
"I have heard men talk to animals before, but never in their own language."
"It's a family peculiarity," Geryon smiled. "At first I didn't believe it either. Birds used to come and talk to Aunt Paul all of the time, usually about their eggs. Birds are awfully fond of talking about their eggs, I understand. They can be very silly at times. Wolves are much more dignified."
He paused a moment.
"You don't necessarily have to tell Aunt Paul I said that," he added.
"Subterfuge, Geryon," Sakath laughed.
"Prudence," Geryon corrected. "I have to go talk with Belgarath. Keep your eyes open. The wolf says that there's some kind of animal out there somewhere. She says it's bigger than a horse and very dangerous. She hinted at the fact that it's a man-eater."
"What does it look like?"
"She hasn't seen it. She has smelled it, though, and seen its tracks."
"I'll watch for it."
"Good idea."
Geryon turned and rode back to where Belgarath and Aunt Paul were deep in a discussion.
"Durdink needs a tower somewhere in the Vale," Belgarath was saying.
"I don't see why, father,"
Polgara replied. "All of Aldor's disciples have towers, Paul. It is the custom."
"Old customs persist, even when there's no longer any need for them."
He is going to need to study, Paul. How can he possibly study with you underfoot all of the time?
She gave him a long, chilly stare.
Maybe I should rephrase that.
Take as long as you need, Father. I'm willing to wait.
Grandfather, Geryon said, reining in. I was just talking with the wolf, and she says there's a very large animal out in the forest.
A bear, maybe?
I don't think so. She caught its scent a few times, and she would probably recognize the smell of a bear, wouldn't she?
I would think so, yes.
She didn't say it exactly, but I got the impression that it's not too selective about what it eats.
He paused.
Is it my imagination? Or is she a very strange wolf?
How do you mean exactly?
She stretches the language about as far as it will go, and I get the feeling that she still has more to say.
She's intelligent, that's all. It's an uncommon trait in females, but it's not unheard of.
What a fascinating turn this conversation has taken,
Polgara observed.
Oh, the old man said blandly. Are you still here, Paul? I thought you'd have found something else to do by now.
Her gaze was icy, but Belgarath seemed totally unperturbed.
You had better warn the others, he told Geryon. A wolf would pass an ordinary animal without comment. Whatever this thing is, it is unusual, and unusual usually means dangerous. Tell Cynedra to get up here among the rest of us. She is a bit vulnerable, trailing along behind the way she is.
He considered it.
Don't say anything to alarm her, but have Lyselle ride in the carriage with her.
Lyselle?
The blonde girl, the one with the dimples.
I know who she is, Grandfather. Wouldn't Durnick or maybe Toth be a better idea?
No. If either of them got in the carriage with Cynedra, she would know something was wrong. And that might frighten her. An animal who is hunting can smell fear. Let's not expose her to that kind of danger. Lyselle's very well trained, and she's probably got two or three daggers hidden in various places.
He grinned slyly.
I would imagine Silk could tell you where they are, he added.
Father,
Polgara gasped. You mean you didn't know, Paul? My goodness, how unobservant of you.
One for your side, Geryon noted.
I'm glad you liked it.
Belgarath smirked at Polgara.
Geryon turned Kretchen so that his aunt would not see his smile. They took a bit more care setting up camp that night, choosing a small grove of aspens backed by a steep cliff and with a deep mountain river at its front. As the sun sank into the eternal snowfields above them, and twilight filled the ravines and gorges with azure shadow, Belden returned from his wide-ranging vigil.
"Isn't it a bit early to be stopping?"
he rasped, after he had shimmered and changed.
"The horses are tied," Belgarath replied, casting a sidelong glance at Cynedra. "This is a very steep trail."
"Wait a bit," Belden told him, limping toward the fire. "It gets steeper on up ahead."
"What happened to your foot?"
"I had a little disagreement with an eagle. Stupid birds. Eagles. He couldn't tell the difference between a hawk and a pigeon. I had to educate him. He bit me while I was tearing out a sizable number of his wing feathers."
"Uncle," Polgra said reproachfully.
"Well, he started it."
"Are there any soldiers coming up behind us?"
Belgarath asked him.
"Some Darshevans. They're 2 or 3 days behind, though. Irvon's army is retreating. Now that he and Nahaz are gone, there's not much point in their staying."
"That gets at least some of the troops off of our backs," Silk said.
"Don't be too quick to start gloating," Belden told him. "With the guardsmen and the Karans gone, the Darshevans are free to concentrate on us."
"Oh, that's true, I suppose. Do you think they know we are here?"
"Zandramas does. And I don't think she'd hide the information from her soldiers. You'll probably hit snow sometime late tomorrow. You might want to be thinking about some way to hide your tracks.
He looked around.
Where's your wolf? He asked Geryon.
Hunting. She's been looking for signs of her pack.
That brings something up, Belgareth said quietly, looking around to make sure that Saenedra was out of earshot. The wolf told Geryon that there's a large animal of some kind in this area. Paul's going to go out and take a look around tonight. But it might not hurt if you nosed around tomorrow as well. I am not in the mood for any surprises.
I'll see what I can find.
Tzadi and Velvet sat on the far side of the fire. They had placed the little earthenware bottle on its side and were trying to coax Zith and her children out with morsels of cheese.
I wish we had some milk, Tzadi said in his contralto voice. Milk is very good for young snakes. It strengthens their teeth.
I'll remember that, Velvet said.
Were you planning a career as a snake herdess, Margravine?
They're nice little creatures, she replied. They are clean and quiet, and they don't eat very much. Besides, they're very useful in emergencies.
He smiled at her affectionately.
We'll make a nice one of you yet, Lysel.
Not if I can help it, Silk muttered darkly to Geryon. They had boiled trout for supper that evening. After Durnik and Toth had finished setting up their encampment, they had adjourned to the riverbank with their poles and lures. Durnik's recent elevation to disciplehood had changed him in some ways, but had not lessened his appetite for his favorite pastime. It was no longer necessary for him and his mute friend even to discuss these excursions. Any time they camped in the vicinity of a lake or stream, their reaction was automatic. After supper, Polgara flew off into the shadowy forest, but when she returned, she reported having seen no sign of the large beast the she-wolf had warned them about. It was cold the following morning, and there was a trace of frost in the air. The horses' breath steamed in the mountain air as they set out, and Geryon and the others rode with their cloaks wrapped tightly about them. As Belden had predicted, they reached the snow line late that afternoon. The first windrows of white in the wagon ruts were thin and crusty, but farther on ahead they could see deeper drifts. They made camp below the snow and set out again early the following morning. Silk had devised a sort of yoke for one of the pack horses, and trailing on ropes behind the yoke were a dozen or so head-sized round rocks. The little man critically examined the tracks the rocks made in the snow as they started up the track into the world of perpetual white.
I got enough, he said, in a self-congratulatory tone.
I don't quite see the purpose of your contrivance, Prince Keldar, Tzadi confessed.
The rocks leave trails that look about the same as wagon tracks, Silk explained. Horse tracks by themselves might make the soldiers coming up behind us suspicious. Wagon tracks on a caravan route aren't going to look all that remarkable.
Clever, the eunuch said. But why not just cut bushes and drag them behind us?
Silk shook his head. If you brush out all the tracks in the snow, it looks even more suspicious. This is a fairly well-traveled route.
You think of everything, don't you?
Sneaking was his major field of study at the academy,
Velvet said from the little carriage she shared with Saenedra and the wolf pup.
Sometimes he sneaks, just to keep in practice.
I don't know if I'd go that far, Lysel, the little man objected in a pained tone.
Don't you?
Well, yes, I suppose so, but you don't have to come right out and say it. And sneak has such an ugly ring to it.
Can you think of a better term?
Well, evasion
sounds a bit nicer, doesn't it?
Since it means the same thing, why quibble over terminology?
She smiled winsomely at him, her cheeks dimpling. It's a question of style, Lizelle. The caravan track grew steeper, and the snow had piled in deeper and deeper drifts along the sides. Miles-long plumes of snow blew from the mountaintops ahead, and the wind grew stronger with a biting, arid chill to it. About noon, the peaks ahead were suddenly obscured by an ominous-looking cloud bank rolling in from the west, and the she-wolf came loping down the track to meet them.
"One advises that you seek shelter for the pack and your beasts," she said, with a peculiar kind of urgency.
"Have you found the creature who dwells here?" Garion asked.
"No. This is more dangerous."
She looked meaningfully back over her shoulder at the approaching cloud.
"One will tell the pack leader." "That is proper."
She pointed her muzzle at Zakath.
"Have this one follow me. There are trees a short way ahead. He and I will find a suitable place."
"She wants you to go with her," Garion told the Malorian. "We've got bad weather coming, and she thinks we should take shelter in some trees just ahead. Find a place, and I'll go warn the others."
"A blizzard?" Zakath asked.
"I'd guess so. It takes something fairly serious in the way of weather to make a wolf nervous."
Garion wheeled Kretchen and rode back down to alert the others. The steep, slippery track made haste difficult, and the chill wind was whipping, stinging pellets of snow about them by the time they reached the thicket to which the wolf had led Zakath. The trees were slender pine saplings, and they grew very close together. At some time in the not-too-distant past, an avalanche had cut a swath through the thicket and had piled a jumble of limbs and broken trunks against the face of a steep rock cliff. Durnick and Toth went to work immediately, even as the wind picked up and the snow grew thicker. Garion and the others joined in, and before long they had erected a latticed frame for a long lean-to against the cliff face. They covered the frame with tent canvas, tying it securely in place and weighing it down with logs. Then they cleared away the interior and led the horses into the lower end of the rude shelter just as the full force of the storm hit. The wind shrieked insanely, and the thicket seemed to vanish in the swirling snow.
"Is Belden going to be all right?" Durnick asked, looking slightly worried.
"You don't have to worry about Belden," Belgarath said. "He has ridden out storms before. He will either go above it or change back and bury himself in a snowdrift until it passes."
"He will freeze to death,"
Tenedre exclaimed. "Not under the snow, he won't," Belgarath assured her. "Belden tends to ignore weather."
He looked at the she-wolf, who sat on her haunches at the opening of the lean-to, staring out at the swirling snow.
"One is grateful for your warning, little sister," he said formally.
"One is a member of your pack now, revered leader,"
she replied with equal formality.
"The well-being of all is the responsibility of all."
"Wisely said, little sister."
She wagged her tail but said nothing else. The blizzard continued for the rest of the day, and then on into the night while Garion and the others sat around the fire Durnick had built. Then about midnight, the wind died as quickly as it had come. The snow continued to sift down among the trees until morning, and then it, too, abated. It had done its work, however. The snow outside the lean-to reached above Garion's knees.
"We're going to have to break a trail, I'm afraid," Durnick said soberly. "It's a quarter of a mile back up to that caravan track. There are all sorts of things hidden under this fresh snow. It's not a good time or place to start breaking the horse's legs."
"What about my carriage?"
Tenedra asked him.
"I'm afraid we'll have to leave it behind, Tenedra. The snow's just too deep. Even if we could get it back up onto the road, the carriage horse wouldn't be able to drag it through the drifts."
She sighed.
"It was such a nice carriage, too."
Then she looked at Silk with a perfectly straight face.
"I certainly want to thank you for lending it to me, Prince Keldar," she told him. "I have finished with it now, so you can have it back."
It was Toth
who broke the initial trail up the steep slope to the caravan track. The others followed behind him, trampling the trail wider and searching for hidden logs and branches with their feet. It took nearly 2 hours to plow out the trail back to the caravan track, and they were all panting from the exertion at this high altitude. They started back down toward the lean-to where the ladies waited with the horses, but halfway down the wolf suddenly laid back her ears and snarled.
"What is it?" Geryon said.
"A creature," she growled.
"He hunts."
"Get ready," Geryon shouted to the others. "That animal is out there."
He reached back over his shoulder and drew Iron Grip's sword. It came out of the thicket on the far side of the avalanche track. Its shaggy coat was clotted with snow, and it shuffled along in a brutish half-crouch. Its face was hideous and chillingly familiar. It had pig-like eyes sunk beneath heavy brow ridges. Its lower jaw jutted out, and two massive yellow tusks curved up over its cheeks. It opened its mouth and roared, pounding on its vast chest with its fists and rising to its full height. It was almost 8 feet tall.
"That's impossible," Belgarath exclaimed.
"What is it?" Zadi demanded.
"It's an Eldrak," Belgarath said. "And the only place the Eldrakin live is in Ulgoland." "I think you are wrong, Belgarath," Zakath disagreed. "That is what's called an ape bear. There are a few of them in these mountains."
"Dear gentlemen, suppose we could discuss its exact species some other time," Silk suggested. "The main question now is whether we fight or run."
"We can't run in this snow," Geryon said grimly. "We're going to have to fight it."
"I was afraid you might say that."
"Well, the main thing is to keep it away from the ladies," Durnik said. He looked at the eunuch. "Zadi, will the poison on your dagger kill it?"
Zadi looked dubiously at the shaggy beast.
"I'm sure it would," he said. "But that thing is awfully large. It would take a while for the poison to work."
"That's it, then," Belgarath decided. "The rest of us will keep its attention and give Zadi time to get around behind it. After he stabs it, we will fall back and give the poison time to take effect. Spread out. Don't take any chances."
He blurred into the form of a wolf. They moved into a rough half-circle, their weapons at the ready, as the monster continued to roar and pound on its chest at the edge of the trees, working itself up into a frenzy. Then it lumbered forward with the snow spraying out from its huge feet. Zadi edged his way uphill, his small dagger held low, even as Belgarath and the she-wolf darted in to tear at the beast with their fangs. Geryon's mind was working very clearly as he advanced through the deep snow, swinging his sword threateningly. He saw that this creature was not as quick as Glol the Eldrek had been. It was not able to respond to the sudden darting attacks of the wolves, and the snow around it was soon spotted with its blood. It roared in frustration and rage and made a desperate rush at Durnik. Toth, however, stepped in and drove the tip of his heavy staff squarely into the beast's face. It howled in pain and spread its huge arms wide to catch the big mute in a crushing embrace. But Geryon slashed it across one shoulder with his sword, even as Zakath ducked under the other shaggy arm and gashed it across the chest and belly with whip-like sword strokes. The creature bellowed, and its blood spurted from its wounds.
"Any time now, Zadi,"
Silk said urgently, ducking and feinting and trying to get a clean throw with one of his heavy daggers. The wolves continued their harrying attacks on the animal's flanks and legs as Zadi cautiously advanced on the raging beast's back. Desperately, the creature flailed about with its huge arms, trying to keep its attackers away. Then, with almost surgical precision, the she-wolf lunged in and ripped the heavy muscle at the back of the beast's left knee with her fangs. The agonized shriek was dreadful, all the more so because it was strangely human. The shaggy beast toppled backward, clutching at its maimed leg. Geryon reversed his great sword, grasping the crosspiece of the hilt,
bestrode the writhing body and raised the weapon, intending to drive the point fully into the shaggy beast.
"Please!"
it cried, its brutish face twisted in agony and terror.
"Please don't kill me!"
Chapter 2. It was a Grolem. The huge beast lying in the blood-stained snow blurred and changed, even as Garion's friends moved in with their weapons, ready to deliver the last, fatal strokes.
"Wait!" Durnick said sharply. "It's a man!"
They stopped, staring at the dreadfully wounded priest, lying in the snow. Garion bleakly set the point of his sword under the Grolem's chin. He was terribly angry.
"All right," he said in a cold voice.
"Talk. And I think you'd better be very convincing. Who put you up to this?"
"It was Narrhadas,"
the Grolem groaned.
"Archpriest of the temple at Himmel."
"The henchman of Zandramas?" Garion demanded. "The one with the white eyes?"
"Yes, I was only doing what he commanded. Please don't kill me."
"Why did he tell you to attack us?"
"I was supposed to kill one of you."
"Which one?"
"He didn't care. He just said to make sure that one of you died."
"They're still playing that tired old game,"
Silk noted, sheathing his daggers.
"Grolems are so unimaginative."
Tzadi looked inquiringly at Garion, holding up his slim little knife, suggestively.
"No,"
Eriand said sharply. Garion hesitated.
"He's right, Tzadi," he said finally. "We can't just kill him in cold blood."
"Hey, Lawns," Tzadi sighed, rolling his eyes up toward the clearing sky. "You do know, of course, that if we leave him here in this condition, he will die anyway. And if we try to take him along, he will delay us, not to mention the fact that he's hardly the sort to be trusted."
"Eriand," Garion said, "why don't you go get Aunt Paul? We had better get those wounds of his tended before he bleeds to death." He looked at Belgorath, who had changed form again. "Any objections?" he asked.
"I didn't say anything."
"I appreciate that."
"You should have killed him before he changed form on you."
A familiar, harsh voice came from the thicket behind them. Belden was sitting on a log, gnawing at something that was uncooked and still had a few feathers clinging to it.
"I suppose it didn't occur to you to give us a hand?"
Belgorath asked acidly.
"You were doing all right,"
the dwarf shrugged. He belched and tossed the remains of his breakfast to the she-wolf.
"One is grateful,"
she said politely, as her jaws crunched into the half-eaten carcass. Garion could not be sure that Belden understood, though he guessed that the gnarled little man probably did.
"What's an Eldrak doing here in Meloria?"
Belgorath asked.
"It's not exactly an Eldrak, Belgorath,"
Belden replied, spitting out a few soggy feathers.
"All right. But how did a Melorian Grolem even know what an Eldrak looks like?"
"You weren't listening, old man. There are a few of those things up here in these mountains. Now, they're distantly related to the Eldrakin, but they're not the same. They're not as big, for one thing, and they're not as smart."
"I thought all of the monsters lived in Ulgoland."
"Use your head, Belgorath. There are trolls in Carrick. Algroths range down into Arindia, and the Dryads live in southern Tolnedra. Then there's that dragon. Nobody knows for sure where she lives. There are monsters scattered all over. They're just a little more concentrated in Ulgo, that's all."
"I suppose you're right," Belgorath conceded.
He looked at Zakath.
"What did you call that thing?"
"An ape bear. It's probably not too accurate, but the people who live up here aren't very sophisticated."
"Where's Narrhadas right now?" Silk asked the injured Grolem.
I saw him at Balassa, the Grolem replied. I don't know where he went from there.
Was Zandramos with him?
I didn't see her, but that doesn't mean she wasn't there. The holy sorceress doesn't show herself very often anymore.
Because of the lights under her skin? The weasel-faced little man asked shrewdly.
The Grolem's face grew even more pale.
We are forbidden to discuss that, even among ourselves,
he replied in a frightened tone of voice.
Oh, that's all right, friend,
Silk smiled at him and drew one of his daggers.
You have my permission.
The Grolem swallowed hard and then nodded.
Oh, stout fellow,
Silk patted him on the shoulder.
When did those lights start to appear?
I can't say for sure. Zandramas was off in the west with Naradas for a long time. The lights had started to appear when she came back. One of the priests at Himmel used to gossip a great deal. He said it was some kind of plague.
Used to?
She found out about what he had said, and had his heart cut out.
Oh, that's the Zandramas we have come to know and love, all right.
Aunt Paul came up along the path, trampled through the snow, followed by Senedra and Velvet. She tended the Grolem's wounds without comment, while Durnik and Toth went back to the lean-to and led out the horses. Then they untied the canvas and broke down the frame. When they led the horses up to the place where the wounded Grolem lay, Tadi went to his saddle and opened the red leather case.
"Just to be on the safe side," he muttered to Geryon, taking out a little vial.
Geryon raised one eyebrow.
"It won't hurt him," the eunuch assured him. "It will make him tractable, though. Besides, since you're in this humanitarian mood, it should also numb the pain of his wounds."
"You don't approve, do you?" Geryon said. "That we didn't kill him, I mean."
"I think it is imprudent, Belgarian," Tadi said seriously. "Dead enemies are safe enemies. Live ones can come back to haunt you. It is your decision, though."
"I'll make a concession," Geryon said. "Stay close to him. If he starts getting out of hand, do whatever seems appropriate."
Tzadi smiled faintly.
"Much better," he approved. "We'll teach you the rudiments of practical politics yet."
They led the horses up the steep hill to the caravan route and mounted. The howling wind that had accompanied the blizzard had scoured most of the snow from the track. Although there were deep drifts and sheltered places where the road curved behind bands of trees and rock outcroppings, they made good time when the road was in the open, but it was slow going when they came to the drifts. Now that the storm had passed, the sunlight on the new snow was dazzling, and even though he squinted his eyes nearly shut, Geryon found that after about an hour, he was beginning to develop a splitting headache. Silk reined in.
"I think it's time for a precaution or two," he announced. He took a light scarf from inside his cloak and bound it across his eyes.
Geryon was suddenly reminded of Relg and the way the cave-born zealot had always covered his eyes when out in the open.
"A blindfold?" Tzadi asked. "Have you suddenly become a seer, Prince Keldar?"
"I'm not the sort to have visions, Tzadi,"
Silk replied. "The scarf is thin enough so that I can see through it. The idea is to protect the eyes from the glare of sunlight on the snow."
"It is rather bright, isn't it?" Tzadi agreed.
"It is indeed. And if you look at it long enough, it can blind you, at least temporarily."
Silk adjusted the covering on his eyes.
"This is a trick the reindeer herders in northern Trastnia came up with. It works fairly well."
"Let's not take any chances," Belgarath said, also covering his eyes with a piece of cloth.
He smiled.
"Maybe this is how the Dalesian wizards
struck the Grolems blind when they tried to go to Kell.
I'd be terribly disappointed if it was that simple,
Velvet said, tying a scarf across her eyes.
I like to have my magic nice and inexplicable. Snow blindness would be such a prosaic thing.
They plowed on through the drifts, climbing now toward a high pass between two towering peaks. It was mid-afternoon when they reached the pass. The track wound up between massive boulders, but straightened out when they reached the summit. They stopped to rest the horses and to look out over the vast wilderness that lay beyond the pass. Toth unbound his eyes and gestured to Durnik. The smith pulled down his protective scarf, and the big mute pointed. Durnik's face was suddenly filled with awe.
Look,
he said in a half-choked whisper. The rest of them also uncovered their eyes.
Baelor, Silk gasped. Nothing can be that big.
The peaks around them, that had seemed so enormous, shrank into insignificance. Standing quite alone in solitary splendor, rose a mountain so huge and high that the mind could not comprehend it. It was perfectly symmetrical, a steep white cone with sharply sloping sides. Its base was enormous, and its summit soared thousands of feet above the nearby peaks. An absolute calm seemed to surround it, as if, having achieved everything that any mountain could, it simply existed.
It is the highest peak in the world, Zakath said very quietly. The scholars at the University of Mersin have calculated its height and compared that with the heights of peaks on the western continent. It is thousands of feet higher than any other mountain.
Please, Zakath, Silk said with a pained look, don't tell me how high.
Zakath looked puzzled.
As you may have noticed, I'm not really a very large person. Immensity depresses me. I will admit that your mountain is bigger than I am. I just don't want to know how much bigger.
Toth was gesturing to Durnik again.
He says that Kell lies in the shadow of that mountain, the smith said.
That's a little unspecific, Goodman, Zadi said wryly. I would guess that about half the continent lies in the shadow of that thing.
Belden came soaring in again.
Big, isn't it? He said, squinting at the huge white peak looming into the sky.
We noticed, Belgarath replied. What's on up ahead?
A fair amount of downhill going, at least until you get to the slopes of that monster there.
I can see that from here.
Congratulations. I found a place where you can get rid of your Grolem. Several places, actually.
Exactly how do you mean get rid of, Uncle? Bulgara asked, suspiciously.
Well, there are quite a few high cliffs alongside this track on the way down, he replied blandly. Accidents do happen, you know.
Out of the question. I did not treat his wounds just to keep him going until you found time to throw him off of a cliff.
Bulgara, you are interfering with the practice of my religion.
She raised one eyebrow.
Why, I thought you knew. It's an article of the faith. Kill every Grolem you come across.
I might even consider converting to that religion, Zakath said.
Are you absolutely certain you're not a Rendish? Geryon said to him.
Belden sighed. Since you're going to be such a spoil sport for this, Paul, I found a group of sheepherders below the snow line.
Shepherds, Uncle, she corrected.
It means the same thing. If you really look at it, it's even the same word.
Shepherd sounds nicer.
Nicer, he snorted. Sheep are stupid, they smell bad, and they taste worse. Anybody who spends his life tending them is either defective or degenerate.
You are in rare form this afternoon, Belgarath congratulated him.
It's been a great day for flying, Belden explained with a broad grin. Do you have any idea of how much warm air comes up off of new snow when the sun hits it? I flew up so high once that I started getting spots in front of my eyes.
That was stupid, Uncle, Bulgara snapped. You should never go up where the air is that thin.
Oh, we're all entitled to a little stupidity now and then, he shrugged. And the dive from that height is unbelievable. Why don't you join me and I'll show you?
Will you never grow up?
I doubt it. And I certainly hope not.
He looked at Belgorath.
I think you'd better go down a mile or so and make camp.
It is early yet.
No, actually it's late. That afternoon sun is quite warm, even up here. All this snow is starting to get soft. I have seen 3 avalanches already. If you make a wrong guess up here, you might get down a lot quicker than you want to.
Interesting point there. We will get down out of this pass and set up for the night.
I'll go on ahead. Belden crouched and spread his arms. Are you sure you don't want to come along, Paul?
Don't be silly.
He left a ghostly chuckle behind him as he soared away. They set up for the night on a ridgeline. Although it exposed them to the constant wind, it was free from the danger of avalanche. Garion slept poorly that night. The wind that raked the exposed ridge set the taut canvas of the tent he shared with Zenedra to thrumming, and the noise intruded itself upon him as he tried again and again to drift off. He shifted restlessly.
"Can't you sleep either?"
Zenedra said in the chill darkness. "It's the wind," he replied.
"Try not to think about it."
"I don't have to think about it. It's like trying to sleep inside a big drum."
"You were very brave this morning, Garion. I was terrified when I heard about that monster."
"We've dealt with monsters before. After a while, you get used to it."
"My, aren't we getting blasé?"
"It's an occupational trait. All of us mighty heroes have it. Fighting a monster or two after breakfast helps to sharpen the appetite."
"You've changed, Garion."
"Not really."
"Yes, you have. When I first met you, you would have never have said anything like that."
"When you first met me, I took everything very seriously."
"Don't you take what we are doing seriously?"
She said it almost accusingly.
"Of course I do. It's the little incidental things along the way I sort of shrug off. There's not much point in worrying about something after it's already over, is there?"
"Well, as long as neither of us can sleep anyway."
And she drew him to her and kissed him rather seriously. The temperature plunged that night, and when they arose, the snow, which had been dangerously soft the previous afternoon, had frozen, and they were able to proceed with little danger of avalanche. Because this side of the summit had taken the full force of the wind during the blizzard, the caravan track had little snow on it, and they made good time going down. By mid-afternoon, they passed the last of the snow and rode down into a world of spring. The meadows were steep and lush and speckled with wildflowers bending in the mountain breeze. Brooks, which came directly out of the faces of glaciers, purled and danced over gleaming stones, and soft-eyed deer watched in gentle astonishment as Garion and the others rode by. A few miles below the snow line, they began to see herds of sheep grazing with witless concentration, consuming grass and wildflowers with indiscriminate appetite. The shepherds who watched them all wore simple white smocks, and they sat on hillocks or rocks in dreamy contemplation while their dogs did all of the work. The she-wolf trotted sedately beside Gretchen. Her ears twitched occasionally, however, and she watched the sheep, her tawny eyes intent.
"One advises against it, little sister," Garion said to her in the language of wolves.
"One was not really considering it,"
she replied.
"One has encountered these beasts before, and the man-things and dog-things that guard them. It is not difficult to take one of them, but the dog-things grow excited when one does, and their barking disturbs one's meal."
her tongue lolled out in a wolfish sort of grin.
One could make the beasts run, however. All things should know to whom the forest belongs.
The pack leader would disapprove, one is afraid.
Ah, she agreed. Perhaps the pack leader takes himself too seriously. One has observed that quality in him.
What did she say?
Sakath asked curiously.
She was thinking about chasing the sheep, Geryon replied. Not necessarily to kill any of them, but just to make them run. I think it amuses her.
Amuses? That's an odd thing to say about a wolf.
Not really. Wolves play a great deal, and they have a very refined sense of humor.
Zakath's face grew thoughtful.
You know something, Geryon. Man thinks he owns the world, but we share it with all sorts of creatures who are indifferent to our overlordship. They have their own societies and, I suppose, even their own cultures. They don't even pay any attention to us, do they?
Only when we inconvenience them.
That is a crushing blow to the ego of an emperor, Zakath smiled wryly. We are the two most powerful men on earth, and wolves look upon us as no more than a minor inconvenience.
It teaches us humility, Geryon agreed. Humility is a good thing for the soul.
Perhaps.
It was evening when they reached the shepherd's encampment. Since a sheep camp is a more or less permanent thing, it is usually more well organized than the hasty encampments of travelers. The tents were larger, for one thing, and they were stretched over pole frames. The tents lined either side of a street made of logs laid tightly side by side. The corrals for the shepherd's horses were at the lower end of the street, and a log dam had backed up a mountain brook to form a sparkling little pond that provided water for the sheep and horses. The shadows of evening were settling over the little valley where the camp lay, and blue columns of smoke rose straight up from the cook fires into the calm and windless air. A tall, lean fellow with a deeply tanned face, snowy white hair, and the simple white smock that seemed to be the common garb of these shepherds, came out of one of the tents as Geryon and Zakath reined in just outside the camp.
"We have been advised of your coming," he said.
His voice was very deep and quiet.
"Will you share our evening meal with us?"
Geryon looked at him closely, noting his resemblance to Vard, the man whom they had met on the Isle of Erkat, half a world away. There could be no question now that the Dals and the slave race in Tormurgos were related.
"We would be honored," Zakath responded to the invitation. "We do not wish to impose, however."
"It is no imposition. I am Berk. I will have some of my men care for your mounts."
The others rode up and stopped.
"Welcome all," Berk greeted them. "Will you step down? The evening meal is almost ready, and we have set aside a tent for your use."
He looked gravely at the she-wolf and inclined his head to her. It was evident that her presence did not alarm him.
"Your courtesy is most becoming," Polgara said, dismounting. "And your hospitality is quite unexpected this far from civilization."
"Man carries his civilization with him, lady," Berk replied.
"We have an injured man with us," Zadi told him. "A poor traveler we came across on our way over the mountain. We gave him what aid we could, but our business is pressing, and I'm afraid our pace is aggravating his injuries."
"You may leave him with us, and we will care for him."
Berk looked critically at the drugged priest slumped in his saddle.
"A Grolem," he noted. "Is your destination
Perhaps Kel? We have to stop there, Belgareth said cautiously. This Grolem would not be able to go with you, then.
We had heard about that, Silk said, swinging down from his horse. Do they really go blind when they try to go to Kel?
In a manner of speaking, yes. We have such a one here in our camp with us now. We found him wandering in the forest when we were bringing the sheep up to summer pasture.
Belgareth's eyes narrowed slightly.
Do you suppose I might be able to talk with him? I've made a study of such things, and I am always eager to get additional information. Of course, Burke agreed. He's in the last tent on the right.